You're listening to the MoneyWeb Now podcast series with Simon Brown. Live streamed every weekday at 6:30 a.m.
Thursday, 31 July. We've got local PPR data, 11:30 a.m. I'm Simon Brown, coming at you live and loud from the MoneyWeb Global Headquarters in Johannesburg, South Africa. On the show today, Kenya Nyana from Scope Prime. There's a ton out there. There was US GDP, there was FOMC, no change, MPC later today, and then, of course, AECI and Glencore. John Reed from the World Gold Council. Central bankers expect reduced US dollar holdings and supply struggles with demand. Brendan de Jong from Portfolio Metrics, managing the overflow of news versus what we actually need to respond to. This podcast is brought to you by Stanlib Asset Management. Invest in more global opportunities through their partnership with JP Morgan Asset Management. Morning headlines, MoneyWeb, deciphering US dollar declines. Its threefold global role provides important lenses through which to think about its relative position. And News 24, Saab's 3% inflation target, short-term pain for long-term gain or an expensive mistake. Morning markets, US was mixed, the S&P down 0.1%, the Nasdaq up 0.2%. The East is mostly green, Sydney a couple of points higher, 0.02% in the green, Tokyo 0.9%, Hong Kong is off 1.2% and Tencent up 1.4%. Commodities mostly red, gold futures 3,345, Brent is the only green at 73.12, platinum 1,341, palladium 1,259, the rand 17.98, Bitcoin 118,500, and top 40 opening call, green open, 260 points or 0.3% higher.
MoneyWeb Now, on the money. Also available on podcast.
Trading now with Kenya Nyana from Scope Prime Care. Appreciate the early morning. Let's kick off with some local stocks. AECI results out. I got to say, a good looking turnaround, and we often don't get to say that, but they do seem to be going in the right direction. The chemicals, of course, is just not a space that anyone is having any fun with right now, but other parts of the business looking okay.
Yeah, I think they had to realign the business in order to get it right. And I think what's quite good about those results is the fact that the net debt is coming down, the net spend on interest cost is coming down. But I think it's them just going and saying, you know what? What can we do to focus on the things that we can get right? And they realize that chemicals and mining is what they always get right. And that's what they've tried to do in terms of that divestiture in the non-core assets. And it's coming to fruition in the results as you see it.
Yeah, absolutely, and it is. And I take your point around debt. I mean, what they've done is I mean, they paused the dividend, but their debt has melted away. What about Glencore? A production update from them. They're also talking about taking $1 billion dollars of costs out by the end of next year. What strikes me with Glencore, in a year of lots of commodities going in the right direction, Glencore is down so far year to date.
And funny enough, they've been buying back shares as much as they've been down. They've been really buying back shares, which means they're quite cash flush. And I think when you look at the production update, I mean, this business is really so well run. I don't think you could really fault them on what they have to get right. For mining stock, where essentially you are a price taker at any single point in time.
Yeah.
All you can control is what you can control, and Glencore controls what they can control. I think the market has just not liked the story, and I think it's just exposure to some metals that I think are not the metals of the future. Mm-hmm. But in retrospect, I think it's still a great operation.
Yeah, absolutely. And to be clear, it's rallied hard in the last little while. And it's got a lot of copper, which, of course, folks are liking. US, let's switch over to America. We had GDP for second quarter out, a 3% number. That after a minus 0.5% in Q1. A lot of moving parts here. But short answer, I mean, 3%, they will take it with both hands every time.
And for me, it's the consumer. The consumer remains very resilient.
Yeah.
And to be perfectly honest, when you look at those numbers, I think if you have to put into perspective with the tariff wars which are going on, for the consumer to go into that economy and continuously spend, it really tells you how much gross savings the consumers have and how much confidence they have in that economy. But I think what was also quite good about the GDP print is the fact that even production from businesses hasn't really tapered off, with these tariff wars.
Yeah, no, I mean, strong numbers. And of course, we've got unemployment data tomorrow, which is expecting to be 4.2. That US economy continues to thunder along. Last question. We had FOMC last night. No change from Jerome Powell and his team. That wasn't a surprise. MPC, 3 o'clock today. Keir, what's your expectation for MPC?
I mean, I was having a conversation with one of my colleagues and I was just telling him that I think that the MPC is taking such a bearish stance and a hawkish stance towards interest rate cuts. And I just believe at the moment they're just viewing these tariffs as just an upside risk that they can't essentially try to predict in their modeling. And I think they will hold. I was reading a lot of reports. My colleagues in the industry do believe that they will cut by 0.25%, and that will be the last cut that they do for the year. So on my side, I just do believe that our central bank governor is too much of a hawk, and he will just try to hold off for rates.
Yeah, he makes hawks look like pigeons in some cases. I take your point on that. But it is, it's going to be a tough call. We'll see, of course, tariffs 30% coming through tomorrow, and that looks like it is going to happen. South Korea just got 15%. I can't see anything happening overnight. We'll leave it there. Kenyon Yon, Scope Prime, always appreciate the time. And our poll today, LinkedIn and Twitter, what do you think the MPC would do? Keir says no change. Consensus is for a quarter. Frankly, we should have a half, I think. Have your vote, have your say, LinkedIn and Twitter. Let your money weather the storms with Stanlib Asset Management. Invest in the Stanlib Global Select Fund, a diversified all-weather equity portfolio sub-managed by JP Morgan Asset Management.
MoneyWeb now, on the money.
I'm chatting with John Reed. He is Senior Market Strategist at the World Gold Council. John, your Q2 gold demand trend report is out. Before we touch on that, I was going through your website and found your Central Bank Gold Reserve Survey 2025 came out last month. What really stood out for me is majority of respondents, 73%, are seeing moderate or significant lower US dollar holdings within global reserves over the next 5 years. This is a fundamental shift. The same survey in 2022, that number was only 46%. It's fundamental. That shift from dollar to, it'll be some euro, it'll be some renminbi, but of course it'll be a whole bunch of gold as well.
No, I think that's quite right. We've seen this trend developing over the past few years, but it's certainly accelerated over the last 12 months. You know, I think part of that is a recognition of the greater economic power coming from other countries, but a lot of it is also recognizing the rhetoric that's come out of the new US administration, which I think is making some holders of US dollar assets really quite concerned.
And we see it going back to the second quarter 2025 gold demand trends. Central banks adding another 166 tons. Pace of buying moderated, but there is still healthy buying at this point. And as per the previous question, likely into the future as well.
I think that's right. I mean, it is a volatile data series, and it is sensitive in a way to the gold price. As the gold price goes up, the proportion that gold makes up of all central bank reserves increases.
Yeah.
And that can reduce the immediate need to add gold to reserves. I think the second thing is as well, is with record high gold prices, the traders at central banks are probably stepping back a bit from the market, not willing to pay the highs and waiting to see where gold settles. It'll be interesting to see what the number looks like in the third quarter now that gold has settled in a still very high range, but well short of the $3,500 an ounce that it hit back in April.
And I like your point, a percentage of holding. I hadn't actually thought of that. And it's also true, as gold sort of stays in a place, we kind of get accustomed to it as well. We also saw mine production ticking up. And in fact, it's behind Q3 and 4 of last year, but up a fair bit on Q1. I imagine maybe there's some holidays there, but the gold miners are, as far as they're able to, coming to the party with supply.
Look, there's a lot of seasonality in mine production, and I think looking at year on year or rolling 12 months is probably a better way to look at these things. But you're right, whichever way you do look at it, mine production has increased a bit this quarter and over the last 12 months compared to the previous 12 months. But when you think how much the gold price has increased, it really does show you the inability of mining companies to materially increase production in the face of these record gold prices. We're in a situation where it takes such a long time to discover, to permit, to finance, to build new mines. The industry is not able to, you know, rapidly dial up gold production in spite of these really high prices. And I think it's a really important element of the move higher in the gold price is that supply looks pretty constrained, not just on the new mine production side, but also on the recycling. For recycling to have only increased by a couple of percent year to date, when you think about how much the gold price is up year to date, I think that's a reflection, as I say, that we're in a supply-constrained environment. So when you do see investment demand growing rapidly, as it has done, something has to give. The price has to go up and jewelry demand has to fall, which is really what has been the story over the last 6 months.
Absolutely. And I take your point on mining. I think with Goldfields, I mean, it's plus a decade from discovery to production. And I don't think any of the gold miners in their wildest dreams really believed a plus 3,000. You mentioned recycling. I was surprised by that. And I suppose there's a lot of moving parts there. But I always thought, you know, and certainly we see it in the PGM space, price up, recycling up. Yeah, it's subdued. And folks are either holding on or just not interested in sending it for recycle.
Yeah, I think the holding on is part of it. Definitely the comments that we're getting back from the industry and from surveys that we're doing is that people expect gold prices to move higher. Mm-hmm. And if you expect gold prices to move higher, then you probably hold on to your gold for the time being. I think the second thing is as well is that in many countries, holding on to your gold is the best bet that you have. If you're in a country that you can't buy international assets, you've got a weak currency, you've got high inflation, holding on to gold is a pretty good thing. And that seems to be what the recycling numbers have shown us over the last 6 months.
Jewelry demand was down. You mentioned that. That makes absolute sense. Some price sensitivity in that space. What struck me going through the data, the inventories were down quite markedly. And I imagine that is price sensitivity. But ultimately, again, as we get accustomed to a plus $3,000 price, that's going to need to restock.
It is. And I think, look, when you're a jewelry shop owner and the gold price is going up a lot, I mean, the easiest way that you can manage that is to sell off the stock that you have and hope that the price comes down so that you can replenish at better levels. To a degree, that's happened in the last couple of months. We've seen gold off of its all-time highs. But as you quite rightly point out, at some point, these stocks will need to be rebuilt. We are seeing some demand destruction in the gold jewelry space, but that's entirely normal. If you go back 30 years, jewelry demand made up 70, 80, 90% of total gold demand. That's declined now substantially, probably at around 30%, although I haven't checked the numbers recently. And again, that's because the price has gone up an enormous amount. So if the gold price keeps going up, I'd expect to see jewelry demand making up a smaller and smaller component of overall gold demand. But the amount of money that people are spending on gold jewelry keeps going up. And that shows me that the underlying demand for gold jewelry remains strong, even if people are buying less of it because the price is high.
Gotcha. You sort of get clever about how you make that piece of jewelry. We'll leave it there. John Reid, Senior Marketing Strategist, World Gold Council. Always appreciate the time. Let your money benefit from experience with StanLib Asset Management. Find out about StanLib Global Select Fund, which follows an investment discipline that has delivered results for 3 decades.
MoneyWeb now, on the money.
I'm chatting with Brendan de Jong. He's Head of Global Investment Strategy at Portfolio Metrics, PMX. Brendan, appreciate the time. In investing, being informed feels right. More screens, more TVs, more price feeds. It does just feel right that we should be consuming more and more noise. It's like a default position we find ourselves in far too often.
Yes, 100%, Simon. That's exactly it. And I think really the problem that we have with that, though, is that with this information, I think investors feel compelled to act on it as well. And I think the purpose of the article that I wrote here was really to challenge that and challenge the assumption that information and being informed is a virtue in and itself. But really, what I'm trying to say here is information is really just that. And it's trying to really know what is the information that makes sense, what you can use, and what mm-hmm. is actual actionable insights within your investment strategy and your long-term plans. So I don't think I'm necessarily saying here that understanding and what is happening in the world or that information is bad in itself. It's really how you use it and what that does to your investment strategy.
Absolutely. It's also, I mean, information is by its very nature, it's historic, it's backward looking, as opposed to markets being forward looking. We get US GDP, it comes in at 3%. That's nice, but that's Q2. We're frankly worried about Q3, Q4 and 2026.
Exactly. Markets move on expectations, not on news. And I like to think about markets as a big discounting machine. And in that discounting, it needs to try and discount what it thinks the future will be, knowing that there's a lot of uncertainty in that future as well. And I think that's really what drives almost counterintuitive movements in markets when news eventually does come out. And that's the very fact that uncertainty almost comes at a cost. And once that uncertainty gets alleviated through the fact that an event has actually happened, you find relief rallies in the market just because of that very fact. Yeah. And also that markets may have already been discounting perhaps a worse outcome and it came out better than expected. And I think this counterintuitive move between data release, which as you say is backward looking, and then what markets do once they actually receive that information can cause quite a lot of confusion with investors themselves. And if they don't really know noise from signal, they can act on this and actually cause quite a big long-term damage in their portfolios.
I like that noise from signal because we're not suggesting that we ignore everything. It's about knowing what matters, what is noise, and what is actually signal.
Yes, exactly. It's noise versus actionable insight into your portfolio. And I think also what's really, really important in this, though, is actually building that strategy, knowing what your objectives are, and then building a robust, resilient, and diversified portfolio to meet those objectives. I think there is a bit of a problem where you as an investor feel like you need to be making a lot of decisions in your portfolios and moving things around based on information. And that can be quite destructive within your portfolio, not only from a poor timing perspective because of the issues that I spoke about regarding markets and expectations and how it actually behaves, but also just naturally from trading and trading costs. I think there's also a disconnect between the confidence of your views and how that is reflected in your portfolios as well, because typically people don't necessarily take into account the possibility of being wrong.
Yeah. And it is. I mean, the market, I mean, the noise part rather than the signal part, it's trying to make me respond. And what you're essentially saying there is that often the best response is to do nothing, is to not respond, actually.
And that is more often than not. I think quite often from a behavioral perspective, we can be our own enemies. And that's where I think the role of an advisor is really a very important one. And that's to help investors stay the course and invest for the long term and not make these knee-jerk reactions. And in this article, I referred to Morningstar's research regarding the behavioral that they very eloquently kind of coined. And over time, that can be quite a destructive force by making those movements in and out of portfolios. And I think advisors play a very, very strong role in trying to calm down the situation and keeping people focused on the long term and their strategy and staying the course, really.
That survey, it's that behavior. It's the sort of we're buying at the top and we're selling at the bottom. We panic late and we get interested late at the same time. And it has massively destructive impacts on a portfolio return over time.
Yes, exactly. And rinse and repeat over and over again. So doing it in the opposite direction over and over again. And it's very, very destructive to portfolios over time.
We'll leave it there. It's Brendan DeYoung. He's head of Global Investment Strategy, PMX. Appreciate the time. That's it for today. We're chatting with Christo De Witt yesterday. He from Luna. Talking around their planned launch of tokenized shares. It's coming next month. It'll be offshore shares. It'll give you 24/5 trading. We asked, are you buying tokenized shares on the blockchain? Just over 40% said you have no need. A third said you will check it out. The rest said you were definitely keen. This podcast is brought to you by Stanlib Asset Management. Invest in more certainty to navigate volatile market conditions. We're live every weekday morning, the MoneyWeb website and the app, 6:30 a.m. podcast just after 7. Thanks to my team, Eddie, Nobuchle, Nicole, to you for listening, my guests for their time. My name is Simon Brown. This is MoneyWeb Now. We'll chat again tomorrow, managing assets.
You've been listening to another MoneyWeb Now podcast, posted every weekday at 7 a.m. on moneyweb.co.za. MoneyWeb Now, on the money.